favorite talking point was the military adage, "Slow is smooth and smooth is fast." He pointed out that the new Shepard had taught his team a good deal about the problems of reusable rockets. "The reason that I like vertical landing is because it's so scalable," he said while unveiling the new Glenn. "Vertical landing is the inverted pendulum problem. You know, if you balance a broom on your hand, you can do that. If you try to balance a pencil on your hand, it's very difficult, because the pencil has a very low moment of inertia. As the vehicle gets bigger, that inverted pendulum problem actually gets a little easier to solve. It's just going to be a matter of can we marshal the resources, as opposed to is there some Nobel Prize-winning technology that I need to go fix?" Smith, who had been hired to scale the company from engineering development to fully operational, told me. The scale of the New Glenn Factory Coombe Operations Center at Cape Canaveral suggests they won't have trouble with the marshalling. The $250 million-plus facility stretches over 140 acres outside Kennedy Space Center. It includes two different operations centers, one for launch and another for on-orbit missions. Customer observation decks, training rooms, and a massive manufacturing facility longer than two football fields where the enormous rocket will be welded together and robots will construct carbon fiber fairings for satellite launches. "It doesn't feel like an aerospace production facility. It feels like Silicon Valley or Seattle, Washington," Scott Henderson, the company's launch operations director, told me. In the course of complying with environmental rules, the company will plant 300,000 shrubs. It will also plant space seeds, flown past the Kármán line by New Shepard. What about the moon? Brett Alexander, the Blue Origin executive who had worked on commercial programs at NASA, elaborated on the company's lunar ambitions in congressional testimony. One of the space advisors in George W. Bush's White House and a key author of that president's vision for space exploration, which called for the astronauts to return to the moon and then Mars, Alexander was now helping shape Blue Origin. "We are prepared to bring private capital to partner with NASA for a return to the lunar surface," he told lawmakers in 2017. The company had designed a vehicle that would carry 10,000 pounds of payload to Earth's nearest neighbor, the equivalent in weight to five Mars Curiosity rovers. The Blue Moon lander could, hypothetically, carry all kinds of scientific payloads to the moon and even bring them back again. It would use a similar engine than the one employed in the New Shepard. It's not a coincidence that James French, the veteran space engineer who envisioned the New Shepard for Blue Origin and continued to advise the company, had begun his career working on lunar landing modules for the Apollo program. Alexander noted that until the New Glenn was completed, Blue's lunar lander could be launched on top of the Space Launch System, the big rocket being built by Boeing for NASA. It was a savvy move for Blue to ally itself with an incumbent competitor and a program favored within the space agency, just as it was smart to invest in building a factory for its new engine in Alabama, home to influential lawmakers. But its ambitions are far bigger than simply carting science projects to the moon for NASA. The partnership that Blue offered was intended to tap into NASA's knowledge and find opportunities for repeated missions. But like SpaceX's partnership with the space agency, it had far broader ambitions. Which may be a good time to stop and ask, why go back to the moon at all? Isn't it fairly barren? Humans have already been there to check it out, after all. That's why Musk is obsessed with Mars. Because it's the next big thing. But there's another narrative at work here. Namely, NASA didn't do a very good job of hunting for anything useful on the moon the first time around, and it was quite on purpose. For safety and simplicity's sake, the Apollo program sent humans to the brightest, most visible spots. They landed mostly on the equator and sure as heck didn't land in any permanently dark craters, Sersel told me. And they didn't have the instrumentation to find the frozen water on the moon. Ironically, it was only after Apollo, when more sophisticated space probes and satellites began examining the lunar surface, that space researchers discovered the presence of volatiles. Scientists speak for compounds like hydrogen, oxygen, and nitrogen, so-called because they have a low boiling point and thus are prone to dissipate. These chemicals are also, however, the stuff of life. One of the unheralded discoveries of space science in recent years is that there is water everywhere, including the moon, says George Sowers. The former ULA executive, who is now leading a program at the Colorado School of Mines, aims to prepare students for the future world of space resource extraction, which is to say, mining all that water in space. For Sowers, water is the oil of space. The most difficult part of launching a rocket is getting it out of Earth's gravity and into orbit. Once there, it's easy to move even heavy weight around. But the more propellant you bring with you from the ground, the bigger your rocket has to be, and you enter a vicious cycle. Remember the tyranny of the rocket equation? The discovery of water in space, however, means that you could make all the propellant that a rocket needs outside the reach of Earth's gravity. Chemically speaking, it's fairly easy to derive oxygen and hydrogen, two common rocket fuels, from water. Humans could also breathe that oxygen and, if they combine it with copious solar power, could grow food. In the view of experts like Sowers and Sersel, whose company TransAstra is focused on space mining as well, this would enable humanity to remain in space and undertake far more economic activity. The big game changer becomes when you can start utilizing space resources, Sowers says. While at ULA, Sowers led the design of a reusable second stage for its next-generation rocket. It would function as a kind of space tug, powered by propellant produced on the moon. A rocket could lift a heavy satellite, or an orbital factory, to low Earth orbit, and the tug could come down and get it. That architecture could lower the cost of doing big business in space, exactly what Blue Origin is aiming for. The lunar South Pole's Shackleton crater contains ice for fuel and logistics support, mineral compounds for developing structures, and near-continuous sunlight for power generation, Alexander told the lawmakers. Shackleton crater and other locations like it offer a realistic proving ground for testing of critical deep space exploration technologies in close proximity to Earth. Blue is hardly alone. The lunar dreams of blastoff are alive and well today. A half dozen private companies have been working on returning to the moon. The XPRIZE organization even created a new version of its space competition called the Google Lunar XPRIZE, eventually promising $20 million to the first group to accomplish basic tasks on the lunar surface. As a testament to the great difficulty of visiting another astronomical body, the deadline for this prize has been extended multiple times because competitors have lacked the money and know-how to get off the ground. Yet several efforts are taken seriously. One is Moon Express, a startup funded by another Silicon Valley internet billionaire, Naveen Jain, and led by Bob Richards, a veteran space engineer. It is developing its own lunar vehicle with the hope of earning money by carrying scientific payloads to the moon and returning with moon rocks that could be sold as souvenirs. Jane sees a tremendous amount of parallels between the internet and space as economic ventures, and his company was the first to win government permission to return to the moon. Another is Astrobotic, a firm spun out of Carnegie Mellon University that is also eager to partner with NASA in sending its Peregrine vehicle to the moon. Astrobotic says it already has a manifest of academic research worth $1 billion to deliver to the lunar surface. Despite the commercial interest, it's not yet clear whether humanity's legal framework for using space, still stuck in a Cold War framework, is ready for capitalism. New laws are being written and debated that would allow companies to claim property rights, or something like them, in space. Some worry that these laws could kick off a potentially destabilizing land grab in space, as companies and countries compete for chemical and mineral resources on the moon, in asteroids, or beyond. More prosaically and profoundly, there is a debate in the space community over whether humanity should explore the moon or choose to aim for Mars, with vociferous takes on either side. Mars became a target in the 20th century before we had good planetary science, Sercel told me. We thought Mars was Earth-like, where people could live. We have to get off this romantic, stupid notion about Mars and think pragmatically about how we are going to justify the expense. The reason Apollo died was because we sent people to the moon and they didn't have anything economically useful to do. For Mars advocates like Musk, the moon is insufficient for the broader goal of settling the solar system. It might be a nice place for an outpost, but you couldn't call it home. We could conceivably go to our moon, but I think it is challenging to become multiplanetary on the moon, Musk said in 2016. It is much smaller than a planet. It does not have any atmosphere. It is not as resource-rich as Mars. It has got a 28-hour day, whereas the Mars day is 24.5 hours. The atmosphere is key, because in Musk's vision, humans will terraform Mars and change its atmosphere to make it breathable for humans and the ecosystem of plants and animals that sustain them. His first major presentation on SpaceX's Martian colonization plans featured an animation of the red planet turning green over time. He joked during an appearance on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert that it might be a good idea to use nuclear weapons to accelerate changes in the Martian atmosphere. One thing is for sure. Humans have mastered the technology for heating up a planet. Space resources still play a big role in Musk's vision. The next big engine Tom Mueller's team is building for SpaceX, called the Raptor, will use natural gas and oxygen as fuel, because it's efficient, and because SpaceX's team believes it can manufacture methane on Mars. Yet even the most opinionated advocates will admit that arguing over destinations creates a false choice. The work of getting back to the moon and spending longer periods of time there will provide important information about what humans will need to survive on the far longer journey to Mars. Most of all, producing propellant on the moon could make longer journeys among the planets more feasible, for the same reasons it makes schemes for space industry cheaper. You don't have to bring all of your propellant with you from Earth. To me, the moon makes sense no matter where you're going, Sowers says. Cutting the cost of a Mars mission by a factor of 3 using lunar mined propellant could be the difference between having a mission and not having it. After the election of Donald Trump in 2016, his administration pointed NASA back toward the moon. The space agency plans to use the Boeing-built SLS to send Lockheed's Orion space capsule on a manned lunar orbit in 2019 to begin assessing the feasibility of an outpost in lunar orbit. That could provide a stepping stone to Mars and beyond. Still, despite Boeing CEO Dennis Muilenburg's boast that the first person that sets foot on Mars will get there on a Boeing rocket, delays still plague the SLS program, and one of the heavy rockets being built by SpaceX or Blue Origin may beat it into space. NASA has also set up a public-private partnership for lunar research akin to the COTS space taxi program. Jason Cruzan, the space agency's head of advanced programs, told me that the government will purchase landing services on the moon from private companies like Astrobotic, Moon Express, or Blue Origin. Musk, ever the pragmatist, updated his own plans in response to this shift. After the Falcon 9's evolution was complete and the still-delayed Falcon Heavy demonstrated, SpaceX would build a huge rocket, the BFR, or Big Falcon Rocket. Or, more crudely among staff, the Big Fuckin' Rocket. It would be some 330 feet tall and 30 feet in diameter, powered by 31 Raptor engines. It would be able to lift 150 tons to low Earth orbit, six times the capacity of the Falcon 9. Notably, it was designed to compete for lunar missions that NASA might undertake, though Musk's goal was to launch an unmanned mission to Mars in 2022, when Earth and the Red Planet are next aligned for a convenient journey. He also added the possibility of flying passengers anywhere on Earth in half an hour. If we're building this thing to go to the Moon and Mars, why not go to the other places on Earth as well? Blue Origin remains focused on the New Glenn, its new engine, and the New Shepard vehicle. Having successfully flown its first iteration five times in a row, the company says it wants to begin flying test pilots and then human passengers in 2018. It hasn't shared the price of admission, but if it can become operational before Virgin Galactic, Branson's rocket company may find itself in trouble. Bezos is passionate about bringing people into space for just a taste of microgravity and a peek at the globe below, even if it seems like a crazy luxury for the rich. Entertainment turns out to be the driver of technologies that then become very practical and utilitarian for other things, the Amazon founder said in 2017. Even in the early days of aviation, one of the first uses of the very first planes was barnstorming. They would go around and land in farmers' fields and sell tickets. Likewise, more recently, the GPUs that are now used for machine learning and deep learning, they were really invented by NVIDIA for video games. New Shepard, that tourism mission because we can fly it so frequently, is going to be a real driver of our technology. Sercel's estimates of the potential space tourism market are bigger than you might think. There are nearly 250,000 people on planet Earth who have spent more than $30 million in spare change, he says. If we can get 4% of them to spend $10 million each on space vacations, that's $100 billion. He expects suborbital tickets to fall from the current market level, Virgin Galactic's $250,000 a seat ride, to just $30,000 to $50,000 per person within 5 years. He predicts orbital tourism will be $3 to $5 million a flight when it matures. Indeed, SpaceX announced in 2017 that two wealthy individuals had put down a deposit to fly around the moon in a Dragon space capsule. Yet SpaceX's real bet on satellite internet is tailored to Elon Musk's entrepreneurial approach. He finds an existing market for products like rockets or cars, then takes it over by pushing that technology to the limit. If 80 satellites could be a successful business, why not 4,000? Blue Origin's ambitions to build out the lunar economy are, in turn, very much in the vein of Jeff Bezos's approach to business. Envision something entirely fantastic, like an invisible store where you can buy everything, or mining water to produce energy on the moon, and figure out how to make it real. As always, however, they find a way to converge. Both companies are focusing their next-generation rocket engines to be built to run on natural gas, not only because of its power, but also because scientists believe it could be manufactured in space, like kerosene. If you don't have disruptive innovation in your DNA, you're not going to understand space resources, Sercel says. Still, there are skeptics who question whether all this effort will catalyze ambitious space projects. This is our third wave of launch developers, but we've never seen them with pockets like this, and we've never seen them with business experience like this. That's different. Carissa Carlson, an economic analyst who specializes in space business, told me. That said, I think there is no guarantee that we're going to see a massive growth in space activity. Still, for all the wild ideas that are embraced by both companies, competition between two well-funded space technology giants is going to be the path forward for the American space program. Even if it can be hard to discern the greed from the humanism, from the sheer love of big, powerful machinery. Bezos' seriousness, just for me, was the fit that said, "We're going to be okay," Garver, the former NASA deputy administrator, told me. She and many others in the space community see the Blue Origin and SpaceX competition as a retelling of the tortoise and the hare. Maybe in this case, the hare will win. And I consider SpaceX the hare. They are also the flashier. Bezos is serious. He wouldn't, and by the way, neither would Elon, be in there if there wasn't money to be made. I love the "I want to advance humanity and save the species," but it's boys and their toys. And Jeff will at least tell you that straight. A few weeks after Bezos announced that he would build a reusable orbital rocket, SpaceX set out to actually reuse its own. It would be only the fourth launch since the Amos 6 fire had grounded the company. After that, engineers torture tested the Falcon 9's carbon-wrapped tanks and found an approach to fueling the vehicle that satisfied the FAA, NASA, and the Air Force. SpaceX returned to flight after a four-month break in January 2017, launching 10 satellites into low Earth orbit for Iridium, delivering another load of supplies and science experiments to the International Space Station, and plunking a satellite into geostationary orbit for EchoStar. While the last satellite was too heavy to allow a landing, the first two missions ended with the Falcon 9 booster returning to Earth. The landings were becoming routine. Between its first successful landing in December 2015 and March 2017, SpaceX had brought back 8 of its Falcon 9 rocket boosters to floating landing barges or to the ground pad at Cape Canaveral. Each time one of the 130-foot-tall, 20-ton metal tubes came plummeting through the clouds before landing in a plume of smoke and dust, SpaceX's biggest fans cheered. Yet, bringing all that metal back from space was worthwhile only if you could reuse it, and often. As Sowers had told me, "It's not the technology that's the showstopper, it's the money side. Can you actually bring it back and refurbish it for lower cost than to build a new one?" SpaceX couldn't answer that question until it actually reflew one of its boosters, and the morning of opportunity dawned clear and bright at Cape Canaveral. Executives from SES, the Luxembourg satellite giant, did an interview with a CBS affiliate on an earthen berm a few hundred yards from the rocket as their satellite on top waited patiently to fly. SES had backed SpaceX for many years, including being the first customer for a geostationary satellite launch. Now it would be the first to fly on what SpaceX had branded a flight-proven rocket booster, which sounds much better than slightly used. One of the execs insisted to me that he wasn't nervous about the launch. His engineering team had satisfied themselves that the refurbished rocket met the same criteria they used when evaluating new rockets. While they demanded a discount for the debut flight, Chief Technology Officer Martin Hollowell told reporters that the company's main goal was to boost the development of cheaper ways to go to space. This rocket had previously launched a Dragon full of supplies to the space station just under a year before. Ahead of its reuse, SpaceX was "incredibly paranoid about everything," in Musk's words, and took 4 months to switch out any components its engineers felt might be questionable, as well as run it through a series of tests at the McGregor test site. Glenn Shotwell, the redoubtable company president, said the process still cost far less than manufacturing a new vehicle. Members of SpaceX's team would admit to nerves, and for all the import of the event, the company declined to promote it as anything other than a normal launch. Still, Shotwell told viewers tuning into the launch live stream that the historic mission is the fundamental key demonstration that our technology is capable of reflight. As the operations team proceeded through the pre-flight checklist, everything seemed fine. No fast fires broke out during propellant loading. There were no last-minute pressure fluctuations or stuck valves to complicate the countdown. Just before 6:30 in the evening, with the sun setting behind it, Falcon 9's flight computers took control, and the rocket ignited. It pushed up through the atmosphere, producing the familiar tearing sound of rocket flight, as if the sky were being ripped open. Over a minute into flight, going more than 1,000 miles per hour and still accelerating, the rocket passed through max Q, the moment when the thickness of the atmosphere puts the highest stress on the rocket. If a strut were to tear loose or some other vital machinery were to give way, it would be now. The Falcon 9 didn't stop. At SpaceX headquarters in Hawthorne, the watching crowd cheered and clapped. At the appointed time, the two stages separated, with the upper rocket carrying SES's satellite further up on its way to a high-altitude orbit. The first stage began to fall back toward the Florida coast, the grid fins that guide it down popping out from their folded position. "All systems continue to be go," a SpaceX engineer told observers. While the second stage coasted through space, the first stage met the atmosphere again. It was aiming for a drone ship, and its engines ignited again to slow its descent. On the video stream, viewers could see one of the grid fins burst into flames, and small pieces breaking off. As the booster plunged through the clouds, condensation covered the camera. Would the flames compromise the rocket's ability to return to the drone ship, "Of Course I Still Love You," waiting a few hundred miles out in the Atlantic Ocean? The camera on the vessel cut out as the rocket approached. It could have been that the satellite link was broken because of too much vibration from the descending rocket, or it might have been another disaster. But when the feed resumed, there it was. A twice-flown booster rocket standing alone on a calm ocean as if on a sunset cruise. History had been made. SpaceX and the private space industry were no longer simply replicating the successes of the government space programs that came before them. They had taken the risk of doing what no one had done before. "I did have, like, two boxes of Xanax. I think that might have helped," Musk joked after the flight. "I was actually, oddly enough, nervous that I wasn't nervous enough." He had brought his five sons to witness the launch, one sign of how much he valued the moment. I asked Musk if he felt vindicated by the successful mission, the product of the past 15 years of work at SpaceX, a company that had begun as a dozen geeks and a mariachi band in low-rent office space. "From a mariachi band to here? Yes, it's a huge day," he said. "My mind is blown, frankly. I'm really quite speechless. It's a culmination of a tremendous amount of work by a very talented team." Hollowell, the gregarious CTO of SES, interrupted. "After SES-8, which is the first GTO mission that we did with SpaceX, I made the comment that the industry will be shaking in its boots. Oh, it is shaking now." "It'll spur change for the better," Musk concluded. And he was not wrong. That same year, not just Blue Origin, but also United Launch Alliance and Arianespace announced plans to develop reusable rockets. With the flight of SES-10, SpaceX was forcing its competitors not just to cut costs, but also to join it in the pursuit of an entirely new approach to spaceflight. "We were ridiculed by the other big companies in the launch business. At first, they ignored us, and then they fought us, and then they found they really couldn't win in a fair fight," Mueller, the engineer Musk found in the desert and unleashed, said after the flight. "And then at some point, they figure out they have to deal with what you're doing. There's a lot of talk about how they're going to make rockets reusable, recover the engines, recover the stages, come up with a much lower cost rocket so they can compete." At the post-launch press conference, Musk was asked about Blue Origin's reusable New Glenn rocket. It was clear that his staff was expecting comparisons with the New Shepard, because they were drilled into constantly mentioning that the Falcon 9 was an orbital-class rocket. "What's that saying about the best form of flattery?" he said wryly. "Frankly, if a company shows that a path is working, then other companies should copy that. It would be silly not to. We wouldn't want to not do the right thing simply because some other company has." SpaceX, Musk admitted, still had a way to go to reach its ultimate goal, true reusability with zero hardware changes and a 24-hour turnaround, which he hoped to achieve within a year. Over the rest of 2017, his company would break ULA's record for most launches in a year, flying two more flight-proven boosters, as well as 10 brand new rockets. It recovered all but two, which were carrying satellites too heavy to allow the rocket sufficient fuel to return. The company was making launch and landing routine, and pushing to do the same with reusability. It was now the dominant player in the commercial launch market. "As an operator, my belief is that within 24 months, SpaceX will offer a service to orbit, and it'll be irrelevant if it's new or pre-flown," Hollowell said. "That's what this means today." For Musk, though, the meaning of the day was far bigger. "The key is going to be reduction of the cost of access to space," he said. "I'm highly confident that it is possible to achieve a 100-fold reduction in the cost of space transport, or maybe more. With the same budget, we do 100 times more things." At first, he explained the reusable Falcon 9 will allow for a dramatic reduction in cost, especially once the company has earned back the enormous funds it expended to develop the vehicle and could price them closer to cost. More important, the vehicle would provide critical learning for the huge Big Falcon rocket he envisions as the key to reaching the moon and Mars. In Mueller's words, "Once we're flying that, all other rockets will be obsolete." Rapid and complete reusability of rockets is really the key to opening up space and becoming a spacefaring civilization and a multi-planet species, Musk said. And now he had proof of the concept. It was a day to celebrate. And he was already more interested in the next big thing, of course, because that's what Elon does. Why couldn't the SpaceX team reuse the fairing that protected the satellite during launch? After all, it cost $8 million. When will they reuse the second stage? Could they launch the Falcon Heavy with its 3 cores and 27 engines before the end of the year? "I want to emphasize that's a high-risk flight," he noted, eager to push the envelope again. His head was stuck in the future, the vehicle he and his team had designed now floating its way back to land after a brief round trip to the vacuum, was interesting only so long as it was considered impossible. "The goal is to make this normal," Musk says, of his rocket and perhaps of his approach to life. "It's just normal. Of course the thing comes back and lands. Why wouldn't it?" Epilogue. A Spacefaring Civilization. Men who have worked together to reach the stars are not likely to descend together into the depths of war and desolation. Senator Lyndon B. Johnson. By the time you finish this book, it's entirely possible that a private company will have flown a human into space again. When they do, and particularly when a private company wins the race to carry astronauts into orbit, the new space race will truly be in motion. SpaceX and Boeing are approaching critical test flights in their quest to be the first company to fly astronauts to the ISS. NASA expects them to begin in 2018. And though delays are likely, the pressure to return human spaceflight to the United States will likely lead both to receive sufficient resources so that Americans can get to orbit without a layover in Kazakhstan. In 2016, NASA issued new contracts to SpaceX, Orbital, and Sierra Nevada for cargo missions to the station through the end of its life. Blue Origin and Virgin Galactic are expecting to begin crewed test flights of their suborbital spacecraft, New Shepard, and Spaceship Two. Their goal of providing regular and safe recreational space tourism, barnstorming past the Kármán line, could be realized in the years ahead, exposing thousands of people to a life-changing perspective of the planet they call home. The real test, however, will come after the inevitable first accident, the tragedy that takes lives. When lives are lost, will the leaders of these various private companies have the mettle and the resources to keep going? Musk has said he will not take his company public, diluting his control over it and exposing it to more scrutiny, until his flights to Mars begin. That may be because only a single-minded desire to move humanity off this planet can propel something as risky as a plan to colonize Mars. In the years ahead, regular human spaceflight and enormous satellite constellations could reshape the space industry. If Blue Origin and SpaceX can realize their visions of giant, reusable rockets that make space 100 times cheaper than it is today, they will indeed change our society. Private investment in space startups has soared, thanks to the promise of these two companies. Is space truly the new internet? Will the first trillionaires be made in orbit, or on the moon, or even on Mars, as the most ambitious space entrepreneurs tell me? I wouldn't risk a prediction. Whenever a lunar business plan seems too attractive, I recall the projections at the beginning of this century, or the 1970s, or the 1920s, to remember that our reach often outstrips our grasp. Yet the largest trends that are driving the push toward cheap spaceflight, the increasingly apparent vulnerability of our ecosystem, and the growing power and importance of global digital communication networks to the worldwide economy, are not going away. Nor are geopolitical conflicts likely to subside. While this book has focused primarily on American companies, their methods, and the technology they use are not limited to the United States. Emerging economic powers like China and India are already investing resources in space technology and aiming to outcompete their American and European predecessors. Once one nation seizes the high ground, the rest can be expected to follow. The veterans of the Strategic Defense Initiative, who poured into private space at the close of the Cold War, are experiencing a sense of déjà vu today as North Korea's nuclear program and renewed Russian antagonism prompt interest in space-based defenses. China has announced that it wants to build a base on the moon, and American space entrepreneurs are already using their ambitions to spur American envy and earn public funding for their own goals. U.S. lawmakers talk of creating a space corps and militarizing space. Sowers, the former ULA engineer, says he tells military planners that the moon is the next Persian Gulf. Space wars, Martian colonies, lunar mines. It all sounds preposterous. Critics of the rocket billionaire's hubris often note that they haven't answered basic questions about what life will be like in space. How will people earn money? How will they live? Can they even survive constant cosmic radiation? The billionaires funding these efforts don't worry about the answers to these questions. Any reasons we may give for wanting to cross space are afterthoughts, excuses tacked on because we feel we ought rationally to have them, Arthur C. Clarke wrote, and it remains true. The U.S. economic system has put enormous resources in the hands of a few space geeks, and they intend to unleash low-cost access to space. Like their peers building social networks and search indexes, they haven't necessarily thought through the potential downsides. The explosion of space commerce could be like the explosion of international trade or effective intergovernmental entities, one former defense official told me, They have power. They have usefulness. They also can cause disruption and disenchantment and dissatisfaction for people who feel like they are not part of that story. If you take one thing away from this book, remember that the technologies to enable a space revolution are being built right now at breakneck speed. They may not arrive as fast as their architects promise, but I am convinced that they will be here sooner than their critics say. It's high time for humans to start thinking about the consequences of becoming a space-faring civilization. Because someday, we will be.
This has been an Audible Studios production of Rocket Billionaires, Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos, and the New Space Race. Written by Tim Fernholz. Performed by Aaron Moon. Executive producers Laura Gatchko and Mike Charzik. Copyright 2018 by Tim Fernholz. Sound recording copyright 2018 by Audible Inc. Audible Studios is a division of Audible Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.